Welcome to Money Maze Curated Podcasts. We created this spin-off channel to highlight a selection of innovative firms in the finance sector and beyond. If you visit www.moneymazepodcast.com, you can also sign up to our newsletter to keep up to date with episode releases and access a range of resources and materials relevant to each guest. If you enjoy this episode, please follow this channel and leave a review. Thank you for listening. On the Money Maze Podcast Curated Channel, we've not discussed global equity long short, and in a world where US equity dominance is being challenged and valuation dispersions between the US, UK, Europe, and Asia are significant, being active, not passive, being able to be long and short might offer compelling investment returns, albeit with attendant risks. And when the owner and CIO of this business states that his fund's ambition is to quintuple capital through returns over 5 to 7 years, it suggests it's worth understanding the approach. So Stephen Roberts, founder of Orgai Capital, welcome today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think you've come in from Jersey and we've had a few conversations and I've been reading your book, which we might refer to later on. And I have been very intrigued about this opportunity set that you're identifying. But I just want to jog back a little bit because I think you start your career at Winterflood. And there'll be people in the audience who will not know, but I just set the scene for what it was that you were doing there and a little bit of how that armed you.
Yeah, I think, Winterflood was the old style stock jobber. And it was really sort of spun out of County NatWest. And a guy called Brian Winterflood, sort of real entrepreneur, real buccaneer, really. And he created it with the backing of Close Brothers. And he got around about 18 dealers from County NatWest. And he started making markets in small cap USM listed stocks. And then I joined the business in early 1991. And really, we built the business from making markets in a few hundred stocks to when I left in 2003 to many, many thousand. We made markets not only in small caps, we made markets in obviously the new AIM index. We then did mid caps, large caps. I then set up the European business. So by the time I left in 2003, you know, we were making markets in businesses like Nokia, Ericsson, France Telecom. So it was really a great journey for me, managing effectively a long short book as a market maker. Having that ability to short is something, it's inherent in me. So ever since I was 19 years old, I've been shorting stocks.
But as we know, all these businesses are subject to disruption. But you saw something which was the trigger for you moving to Horseman. Just sort of, again, frame us with what you observed.
I think, you know, for me, you know, I was always sort of paranoid. My father was, he had laundrettes in Liverpool and they were very successful in the 70s. And ultimately, he was disrupted because, you know, people weren't living in sort of back-to-back housing. They didn't have washing machines those days. Then, you know, houses simply had washing machines and the way of life changed. And I could see that people weren't going to be going through his door to wash their washing. And for me, you know, I saw a business that was very successful really over time slowly fade. And for me, I sort of had this feeling sort of post 2001 that the market making business was a laundrette. I could see it being disrupted before we could make markets and nobody could compete with us apart from other market makers. And obviously because of technology and the way markets evolved, people could interact with our prices and effectively kill our margins. So as the business model evolved, and as computers became more powerful and many more market participants could get involved with actually setting share prices, the margins of that business just collapsed. And I could see that happening before my very eyes. And I just didn't want to be like my father, even though I was very successful. I could see that the road had a limited, you know, runway, really. And at the same time, the hedge fund space, people started making money in that area. And being long short background, I was naturally, sort of pushed into that area, you know, to look at.
So you joined Horseman and you're there for a long time. Just give us a sense of the skills that you had to either evolve or acquire.
What I found working at Winterfloods, ultimately the sector you worked on really made the trader. So you'd have people at the end of the year saying, you know, we want to be paid this much bonus or that much bonus. But they might have been making a really good job of a bad sector. You know, so therefore, you know, if you look at like 98, 99, 2000, the guys who were making the most money ultimately had the tech stocks, was the guys who were running the mining book. You know, nobody was interested in mining. But at some, you know, as a business, you have to keep the traders interested and, you know that every dog has its day. And for me, really, my time at Winterfloods really showed me that the sector approach, really, once you get the right sector, everything else follows as far as investing. And then I met up with a guy called John Horseman. Obviously, he established Horseman Capital. And he very much thought about this sector approach and this bigger macro approach. And really, it was all about picking the right themes and the right sectors and then picking the stock. So I knew I was a good stock picker at Winterfloods. And over the time of my sort of 13 odd years there, or 12 years there, I really developed the fact that I could identify what I thought sectors would do well and what traders should be doing well. So that was a skill set I sort of learned without really realizing I was learning it.
So that's a European long short fund that you ran for a long time. Eventually, you know, you move and retire. I think that's right. And you move to Jersey. And, you know, for a lot of people, that would be great, a successful career. But of course, here you are. You've been managing your own money through your family office, and now you've created the vehicle that we're going to talk about. But just explain about, you know, the motivation to come out of that settled status and back into the war zone.
Yeah, as in, for me, I just, sometimes you don't realise what you enjoy. And as soon as I sort of disengage from markets, I really miss them. And, you know, it was only a matter of a few months. My wife would say, you know, why are you sitting at your Bloomberg? And, you know, I realized that I really, you know, it was something that I was very passionate about. And I really sort of missed markets. And even though I was sort of retired, I did look at them, not as obviously as much. But I also could see, you know, for me, a European hedge fund, certainly towards the, you know, from 2015 to 2020, again, became a laundrette. You know, I would go in and the first thing they would talk about would be like Brexit and or the debt crisis in Germany or debt crisis in Greece or quantitative easing. So for me, trying to talk about investing was very difficult because these big key issues, people just had a serious issue with. And naturally, you could see money was just being taken out of the whole sector. So again, for me, it was a bit like Winterfloods in 2001, 2002. Running a long short European hedge fund was a laundrette.
And of course, we know that the divestment from European and UK equity markets and the, you know, enthusiasm, exuberance around the US is reflected in these, you know, dramatically different weights and valuations. Is that the driving force for wanting to create this global vehicle?
No, really. I think interest rates at 4.5% is. You know, when you've got a market where interest rates are zero and people are just printing money or central banks are printing money, it's very difficult to really, my thematic way of investing, really the sort of the playing field, the pitch we are playing on was effectively just being manipulated. Whereas now with interest rates where they are, it's a much fairer environment to actually make or take risk.
Got it. So Orgai Capital, can you just summarize its aims?
It's to quintuple capital over the next 8 to 9 years. So it means that I think I can annualize a 20% compound.
Right. And it's global equity, long short. Some might say, well, your history was investing in European markets. You've now got a global mandate. Why do you think that your skill set is so easily transferable?
Because, you know, sitting within Horseman, I sat with, you know, John Horseman, which is probably one of the best global managers around. I also sat in a room with Russell Clark. These are very big macro guys. So really sitting in an environment over 15 odd years, you do pick up a lot. And in some ways for me, my way I invest is still very thematic sector driven. It just, I was very pigeonholed on you know, if you like tech, you know, what you'd buy SAP in Europe. Whereas if you like tech with a global mandate, you know, I can invest in China, I can invest in US tech. So for me, it's all the same thing, really. And I wanted to get rid of this European mandate.
Yeah, well, I understand that. And I've been reading your book, which is How to Follow Your Instincts on the Stock Market. And there are lots of very straightforward, well-expressed lessons. It's back to that Warren Buffett, it's simple but not easy. And I think you describe your philosophy, you know, very well. But you're also being very entrepreneurial, because we know in the world of these vast pools of capital and huge amount of sort of indexation, you know, the wind's in your face if you want to set up a new business. And so I guess that, you know, how daunting have you thought this prospect is?
I wanted to, first of all, I moved into John Horseman's hedge fund, and he was, you know, very encouraging. We set up the European business within that. In some ways, I had a real scratch to itch as far as I wanted to set up my own hedge fund. And I've done it along with the former CFO of Horseman, Chris Harrison. So really, once we get these professionals in the room, Chris Harrison and Oliver Hall, who was also at Horseman, it was very relatively straightforward to set up. You know, people say how difficult it is to set up a hedge fund. I would tell them that it's not difficult.
Right. When we talk about some of the fund details, we'll come back to your partners and providers, and it's an impressive list that you've assembled. Let's talk about that investment approach. I note in your materials you say thematic research backed up by macro overlay and fundamental research. And you've hinted at these thematics, but just distill your investment approach.
Really, it's just, you know, it's what we're engaging with on a daily basis. Everything, investing is there. You touch and feel it every day. You watch adverts on TV or on YouTube. Look at the businesses that are advertising. If you look at, say, the car industry, you know, we all know it's being disrupted by electric cars. You know, that's a sort of a starting point. You know, you've had phenomenal investments like Tesla, BYD. You know, these, I'm telling you all these names, these are very obvious names that people interact with on a daily basis. So I'm just sort of keep my eyes open and, you know, find out what my children are doing, what they're interacting with, you know, what they're buying, what's trending. And just really, I feel as though investment managers, you know, they in some ways are too closeted. They don't sort of go outside and sort of smell the roses, as it were. You know, for me, investing is around us. You know, you wake up in the morning, you clean your teeth, you switch on Microsoft, you look at your Apple iPhone. These are all investable businesses.
Well, it was the great Fidelity fund manager,
Peter Lynch.
Thank you very much. He used to say Saturday was the most important day as a portfolio manager because, of course, you visited the stores, you asked the questions, and I sometimes kick myself for having seen a brand or a business that impressed me at the time, and I didn't stop and process it and join those dots. And, you know, people do overcomplicate it, and the industry is full of, you know, smart people and smart words. And, you know, a lot of this investing business is about doing the basics and understanding. But let's just take it to the next level of some of these big themes. And I know you're on CNBC the other day talking about some of them, which are very different from UK housing to China technology. Maybe just start with that UK housing supply issue and what you're identifying, because that's something that won't have come from talking to your children. It comes sure. from something else that you picked up. I'd like you to just sort of set the stage for why you're allocating capital there.
You know, I think it's like everything, you know, house builders, when to, as an equity investor, when to buy a house builder. Ultimately, it's like, when's the best time to buy a house? You know, the best time to buy a house is probably after some type of recession. You know, if you lock yourself into a mortgage now, the likelihood is mortgage rates are probably going to fall. Plus also COVID, you know, again, COVID caused, you know, less houses to be built So like, you know, you look at the big UK house builders, they're building around 15 to 20% less houses. But then you look at obviously population flows into the UK, and everybody, you know, is not surprised to know that population, there's huge population growth still. And so therefore what we've got is we've got a structural undersupply of housing. We've now got a government who's probably going to be slightly effectively saying, you know, we need to build more houses. But ultimately, this all hinges on where I think interest rates are going. And ultimately, for me, as a macro guy and looking at the world, I personally think we're probably within 1 or 2 years of interest rates now starting to ease, and the effects of COVID and inflation now coming through the system. And ultimately, in the UK, we've now got wage inflation running probably above core inflation. That means, you know, the man on the street, wages are still growing, and now you see oil prices now falling. So everything now from a macro perspective in the UK, also you've got the pound is starting to appreciate. You've got relatively high bond markets as far as, you know, 30-year treasuries or 30-year gilt yield and 5.5%. That's going to attract capital into sterling. So there's lots of sort of macros that are going on, which makes me sort of much more confident. But more importantly, we're only paying sort of book value for these businesses. And they're already paying 5, 6, 7, 8% dividend yields. So therefore, as a bet and allocating capital to this bet, I'm basically paying book value. I'm getting paid whilst I'm waiting for this macro to come through. So the risk reward on this trade is probably as good as it gets.
Got it.
So I can sit back, get paid. And if interest rates are cut, Bank of England do start cutting interest rates, then you've got a tailwind.
Okay. Let's switch geographies and sectors. You've written about the Chinese dynamic, which is this shift from fixed asset investment to consumption. All of the attendant risks that go on with China geopolitically. But let me understand how you're processing that and where that's led you in terms of the names that you own today.
You know, China, for me, I remember Chinese GDP going through a trillion. I think that was probably like 98 or something like that. And we made some very big gains at Horseman playing commodity stocks between 2004, probably to 2011. Commodities were in a significant bull market at that stage. Now they're in a bear market. China for me is not new. I've followed China for 25 years. Now you've basically got, again, a bit like the UK, you've had property prices being hit 30%. So now in the last 10 years, the best time to probably buy a house in China is now, because prices are down 30%. So the risk reward again is looking good. Then you've got the biggest beneficiary of falling oil prices. The two biggest economies who are biggest beneficiaries are probably China and India. So therefore, now you've got a big tailwind from lower energy costs coming through the Chinese economy. Then you also look at the Chinese consumer. And as we all know, the Chinese save a hell of a lot of money for all different reasons historically. But as far as their economy, I think consumption's around 38%. Whereas you look at US, consumption's around 70%. But then you look at the Chinese banks, and they've got around $20 trillion of deposits. Ultimately, the Chinese government have now, they realized that they've hit headwinds as far as exporting product to certainly places like America. And now they're now openly saying, mandating that they're going to increase consumption as far as the part of their GDP. So therefore, you've got lots of dynamics going on. Now, the recent trade wars, from a market perspective, the trade wars that have just played out, the Chinese didn't depreciate their currency. So again, that's another big tick, big indicator. So for me, the macro setup for China is as good as it gets. And I haven't seen a better macro setup probably since 2004, 2005, when they drove commodity prices. Now, if I'm right about consumption becoming a bigger portion of GDP over the next decade, if I'm right that, you know, I think we're at the bottom of some type of property correction in China. And I'm right about much lower commodity prices as far as oil prices and how they transition their grids over to sort of lower cost energy, then the risk reward again in this investment, this is why I think I can quintuple capital, it's as good as it gets as far as being able to make double digit and, you know, buy stocks that can double, treble, quintuple.
And let's take an example. I think you are an owner of Alibaba.
Yes, I still am, yeah.
Yeah, so just talk us through the thesis.
Well, really, from a bottom-up perspective, when we started buying this business, you know, we were paying effectively 6 times EV EBIT. Again, the beginning of last year, they announced that they were going to start increasing their buyback, that they'd also increased, that they'd announced a dividend. Now, this is very un-China-like. So it was as though policy beginning of 24, the Chinese government turned around and said, right, we're going to allow you guys to increase your dividend and actually increase your buybacks. And again, a lot of these Chinese businesses like Alibaba have got substantial amounts of cash on the balance sheet. So again, from a risk-reward perspective, these businesses, you know, you weren't paying anything for them. And then if you look at, say, Alibaba, you know, effectively it's got a monopoly in the cloud business in China. So, you know, that business now, I think the Alibaba cloud business run rate's around $15 billion a year. Google's run rate as far as cloud is $50 billion. Something like an AWS run rate is, I don't know, $125 billion. But the runway for Alibaba cloud going from current run rates of $17, $18 billion to $100 billion, I can see that happening. Now, that is probably a 35% margin business. So, you know, Alibaba cloud over the next decade could easily be making $25 billion plus profit a year. Now, I was paying, you know, an EV EBIT, you know, 6 times earnings for that stock. It was capped at 130 billion when I was buying it. You know, it's just so wildly cheap.
I understand that. And there's some fantastic, you know, valuations across, you know, the Hong Kong Chinese markets, which, you know, I've observed as well. Let's just play out a scenario that whilst the investment opportunity that you've articulated is there, we wake up one morning and we've got significant escalation of tension between around Taiwan. How, as a portfolio manager, are you going to think about that? Because, you know, we saw with Russia and Ukraine what can happen to, you know, foreign listed shares being sort of, you know, blocked either by one or the two of the geographies. How do you think you would be responding?
Obviously, Taiwan, I think it will happen. Probably. I do think there's a grand plan for Taiwan. I don't think they're going to just take it overnight. I think what you see with TSMC and how, in some ways, Trump is repositioning supply chains. All businesses now, be it Apple, be it Tesla, that they're building their supply chains on the event of this possibly happening. So therefore, for me, I don't think it's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years, but I do think probably by 2035, it probably will happen. But by that point, I think the US will probably just let it sort of wither away, because US businesses and European businesses would have de-risked their supply chains out of Taiwan. So whilst, you know, we could wake up tomorrow and all of a sudden China's invaded Taiwan, these stocks would take a hit. I think there would be a liquidity event around it. And it's something I would have to withstand if it happened overnight.
Yes. Well, Neil Ferguson, who I listened to the other night, was actually suggesting that what we may see is not the military invention, which we know is very difficult, or even the blocking of the straits, is the imposition of a tax on all flows in and out of Taiwan. And that would have the effect of achieving the economic dominance or influence that they want. We've talked about the long side. The short side, let's turn to, partly because fewer and fewer people are doing it. We've had Carsten Block on the show. We had Chris Dale of Kibri Capital talk about his show. But as we know, a lot of the funds have either abandoned it in the face of poor performance, a little bit the relentlessness of passive, particularly in the US, but you have embraced it fully. So just tell me how you're approaching it and what are the dynamics that you want to see to get short?
You know, in 2007, 2008, we did very well. You know, we shorted banks. You know, my assets, my European fund went up a hell of a lot during that period. I went to the US in 2007, you know, Allied Irish Bank, Bank of Ireland, Bradford and Bingley, Northern Rock. I basically thought there's zero. So, and I would say my stronger point is the short book. I quite like the short book. And there's times to use it, but it's knowing when to use it and when not to use it. Okay, so for me at the moment, if you're bearish, just buy bonds. You've got a real yield, which is very nice because we haven't really had a real yield for over a decade. So if you're bearish, go and buy 30-year treasuries, you know, or buy some gilts. So, and you get paid. As far as the other shorts out there, there are sort of stock-specific shorts, you know, and you can mention a few, but you're never going to really move the needle as far as your performance with those shorts. The only sectors I can see that are sort of obvious shorts are European car manufacturers. For me, I personally think their equity is zero. You know, if you handed me Volkswagen now, I would say, pay me $20 billion and I'll take it off your hands. I think it's that bad. And, you know, and that goes for BMW, Volkswagen, Renault, all of them, Stellantis. I can't see any value within their equity. For me, they look worse than Lehman Brothers. So for me, as far as a sector in general, European autos look like the banks in 2008. As far as the other sectors, they all look probably the right valuation, even the bad sectors like oil and gas. You're not going to make a lot of money shorting those names because of the cash flows and the dividends and what have you. So for me, shorting is a difficult environment at the moment. I think if you're short, buy bonds, and the obvious shorts are obviously European autos.
And I think some of the listeners would say, oh, Simon, you didn't push him on that European, you know, zero value of these car companies. So just help me. Is it because they have high fixed costs, they haven't adapted to the world of, you know, electric vehicles, their supply chains are, you know, in the wrong places? Is that just basically it? They're just ill-equipped for the world ahead?
Unfortunately, yes. You know, they're just laundrettes.
Right. You have made the statement that you want to be the biggest bull in a bull market and vice versa. Let's just talk about what that means in deploying capital. And I'm meaning now I'm talking about portfolio construction.
I think the big thing investors need to realize is, are we in a bull market or a bear market? So, you know, people talk to, and I go, are we in a bull or bear market? We're in one or the other. And most people can't answer that question. So for me, we're in a bull market. And the reason we're in a bull market is because all my longs are making money. And when they draw down, they then draw back up again. We're clearly in a bull market in many sectors of the stock market. Something like China, people talk about China and, oh, we've got a weighting in China. You know, you hear these four portfolio managers talk about a weighting in China. Then I go through their portfolio and they've got like a 3 or 4% weighting in China. You know, they write reams and reams on this topic. And actually they're just worse than an index. So for me, I'm just very clear at what I do. If I'm long China, I am very long Chinese consumption. You know, we don't sort of, if I'm short of European autos, we've got a decent enough size there that we'll make money out of it. And I just think for me, investment management is now very wishy-washy and people talk, but when you actually look through the portfolio, it's a different optic.
So I absolutely see that. And we've had a lot of sort of quasi-indexation going on under the name of active. You've got risks on both sides of the book, the longs and the shorts, and you're employing leverage. And we'll come back to some of those fun facts, you know, in a minute. Just tell me how you think about risk management, because, you know, the industry, again, has come up with lots of very clever terms. And we know VAR, value at risk, was one the banks loved and proved to be absolutely unhelpful in 2008. How do you think about risk?
For me, when I buy stocks and when I buy shares, I actually buy the whole company. So I own Alibaba. I look at that. If I'm happy to own that stock. I'm not looking at market risk, or I'm looking at the valuation of business. Where you lose money, as we all know in the stock market, is when you pay too much money for something that's just not growing. Where you make a lot of money is when you buy something very cheaply that's clearly growing a lot more than what the market anticipates. So you could say even obvious things like a Zempec Novo Nordisk was a stock that I really liked, but I didn't like 50 to 60 times earnings for it. So thematically, I was like, this is really interesting. Looked at it. It was already on 50 times earnings. Now, if you buy that stock and the earnings don't come through, you're going to lose money. Now, that stock's down, I think, you know, it's halved. Yep. But now I look at that stock, it's on 17 times earnings. I still like the theme. There's obviously more competition. For me, as a risk reward, that is much more investable business now. So for me, it's all about risk, is about what you price you pay for the theme. Now, there's lots of themes out there. Like if you now like European defense, people go, oh, well, I love European defense. Now, are you happy to pay 50, 60 times earnings for Rheinmetall? Now, I'm not, because I think there's too much risk in that theme, because lo and behold, you can guarantee that the governments are going to be slow to move. The earnings aren't going to come through as quickly. And there's going to be a lot of disappointed people. So for me, what I do is my risk reward is how I look at risk is I buy things that probably other people don't want, but I can see in the future them probably looking to buy it and have this PE expansion. So for me, risk and reward is all about what you pay.
It's what Warren Buffett said, isn't it? Buy inexpensively and stay patient.
Yes.
Before we leave the sort of the investing universe, I'm quite intrigued because you've talked about the commodity universe, and I spend time thinking again, like you, about where to deploy capital. We've had a pretty big bear market in these commodity names, Anglos, Glencore, Rios, etc., Big Yields right now, and a lot of rebuild and some structural shortage ahead. What would get you interested in the big commodity names?
Well, I'm starting to buy them. You know, one piece of the jigsaw that we're missing is a weak dollar. You know, as we all know, emerging markets like a weak dollar. Now, so for me, I'm not one of these sorts of people that I think the, you know, reserve currency of the US is going to disappear. I just don't, I'm just not buying into that. But I do think there's been a crowding of money into the US dollar. And I can see why that's happened, but I can also see reasons why it probably got too far. And now it's probably going to unwind that. So fundamentally, I still like the dollar, but I do think it will weaken across other currencies. Now, that is very good for commodities. Then I look at transmission networks, and I look at what China is doing with their transmission networks. I look at what US is doing. I look at AI infrastructure build. I look at what Europe needs to do as far as... So for me, copper is at some stage, it's going to probably double in the next decade. So if you said to me, you know, if there's one thing, if there's one commodity that I could sort of drop off in your driveway in Jersey and you happily over 10 years without looking at it, I'd say just drop me off tons of copper and I just sit it in my garage because I know that at some point the price of copper is going to move a lot. But also more importantly, now it's very difficult for the big mining companies to build a new copper mine, as we all know. So for me, it's a case of timing this trade. It's not a case of if it's going to happen, it's when it's going to happen. Now, for me, you need to start legging in slowly into these names. Now, I was sort of a trader for a long time. You know, something like a Glencore, you know, their business is now starting to look interesting. Its trading business is starting to look interesting. It's starting to buy back equity in its own business. You know, it's got a very high free cash flow yield. The risk reward of owning these names now hasn't been as good, I would say, since 2005, 2006.
So
for me, these stocks like Glencore, and we have to remember things like Glencore were heavily traded stocks, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Now you look at it, participation in the names are very low. Private client investors just aren't interested in these names. For me, these are all great entry points. Will I scale them up? I think I will, but I'm going to be slow doing it because I don't want to also be involved. It's something where I get into a value trap with them, where I'm still holding 3-4 years time and it's dead money when other things are more obvious. So I am slowly legging into that trade.
Got it. And you mentioned that copper shortage, which I absolutely subscribe to. And in fact, the other interesting thing is you look around the world, and that's what I spend a bit of time on, is you've got some very underpriced currencies. Aussie and Canadian are two of them relative to their purchasing power. Let's talk about the fund's structure itself. A few short-ish questions for people who are listening who may want to learn more. Fund structure, it's a Cayman feeder, is that right?
Yeah.
And you couldn't buy it in any of the share currency classes?
No, it's only US dollar.
Only US dollar. What is your remit in terms of, it's a predominant in equity long short, but you've talked about bonds. What can and can't you buy?
I've left this relatively, for me, this is my capital. At the moment, it's all equities, okay? But I'm not saying that I can't, if all of a sudden something happens in the world, you know, the 30-year treasury is up at 7%, you know, and I think that's probably a good point to buy it. You know, there could be an instance in 3 or 4 years' time where I am just sitting on bonds, expressing bearishness using bonds.
Got it.
But I would, the predominance of the my returns is always going to be the equity book.
Right. So broad mandate, which I think is, you know, refreshing and right because you don't have your hands tied, but quite concentrated. Are we talking sort of 40-ish equity names?
Yeah, 40 to 60 names.
Okay. And that's long and short?
Yes.
Okay. Your fees?
1.5 and 20.
Right. And the liquidity terms?
It's monthly and 90-day with 90-day notice.
Okay. And I note that your providers, your prime broker, Goldman Sachs, your auditors, EY, your lawyers, Simmons & Simmons, your custodian, Northern Trust, you know, tell me a little bit about how you thought about who you wanted to partner with, and then just a little bit about your team.
You know, Apex, the administrator, you know, they're very dominant in Jersey. Again, been doing it a long time, a lot of funds. Goldman Sachs, I've had a relationship with Goldman Sachs ever since my Horseman days. Again, it's just people we've used in the past who are, you know, very good at what they do.
You are the substantial investor, you know, in this fund with your own capital. Thinking about people listening to this, is that what type of investor is best suited for what you're doing?
You know, I take calculated risk, and sometimes, you know, we obviously get it hopefully right more than we get it wrong. You know, if you're looking to get, you know, a steady 5, 6, 7% a year, then this is not for you. You know, I say to people, you know, allocate a little bit of money, like 1 or 2% of your net worth. And then if you get comfortable with what I'm doing and you understand what I'm doing over time, then add, I'm going to do this obviously for a long time. And when I say long time, 7 to 8 years, you know, I do take risk and you have to be aware that it can go wrong.
Sure. And so what in your mind would be the size that you'd be comfortable in terms of assets managing?
That's a difficult question. You know, this strategy, I could run many billions of dollars. Horseman, I ran over $1 billion. You know, as in, it's really about getting the right people on board who understand the process. And that for me, the size of the AUM is not an issue at the moment, but at some point I probably will just say, right, we're going to cap it. That's it. No more investors. Because, well, you know, I do this because I enjoy it. I don't want the business to overtake me. I do this job because I enjoy it. I like expressing myself. And if I can't express myself because I've got too much AUM and it becomes a bit of a sort of large VLCC, then, you know, I'd start handing money back to investors.
Well, I know because I went from Morgan Stanley to Vantage, a hedge fund, and you need, as the business builds, so the business complexity itself that you may not have wanted comes back in and you become, you know, a business administrator as well. Just tell me about who's on your team and where they've come from.
Well, you know, again, Chris Harrison, our old CFO, Oliver Hall, our COO from Horseman. Then I've got Patrick, who's my number two. Patrick worked with me at Horseman. He's worked with me for over a decade. He's very loyal. He knows the process. He knows, you know, so he'll sort of know what I'm thinking, and then he'll do a lot more of the bottom-up work and, you know, monitoring things and just keeping on top of things. So the really people I've worked with for, you know, well over a decade. I've brought Alex Bennett on board. He's also in investment relations and helping me grow the business. He used to be a broker of mine. He used to do a lot of execution for me, so he knows how I work. So he's helping with that side of the business. So, yeah.
And I'm smiling because I think it was the late Charlie Munger who said something about how many analysts you should have in a group. And I think I might be paraphrasing it, but two analysts is one too many. You're making the investment decisions here. How much and what type of investment support do you want?
Well, just Patrick. The worst thing I can have is noise. You know, I'm playing big macro trends. I'm playing big themes. And, you know, it's like grains of sand. You know, you get signposts every day. Things don't change overnight. So, you know, things like the tariff sell-off, you know, that was a great opportunity for me. We could pick up some stocks, you know, that we really like quite relatively cheaply. It gave us an opportunity to add to some of our China bet. So again, there's less noise is better.
Very true. So Stephen, we always close these conversations with a few general, unrelated or possibly related. You've been in this business for quite a while. What would you say is your biggest frustration with the investment business worldwide today?
I think for me, there's no real exciting managers. I look at the hedge fund space now and it's just built for 4-7% returns. You know, it's all about no volatility. And for me, you know, what got me initially interested in the business are the likes of Soros, you know, the Buffetts of the world who can deliver, you know, outstanding returns. And for me, that's the exciting part of this business. And for me, I think it's a great shame that a lot of people now coming through investment banks that all risk manage within an inch of their lives, and they're not given the way to express themselves. You know, Winterflood's, I could express myself. You know, John Horseman let me express myself. And now everybody's just risk managed. And I feel as though it's killing talent. And for me, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to come back is because, you know, I do think the industry misses managers who can make 40, 50, 60% in a year. You know, there's lots of people out there who probably can do that, but they can't because they haven't got the ability to do it with the seat they're sitting in. And for me, you know, I sort of want to bring that back to the industry. And, you know, that's one of my frustrations.
So we get quite a lot of commentary, you know, particularly via LinkedIn of people who listen to the show, etc. We had quite an interesting younger person ask where have all those managers gone. Funnily, the other day we were lucky enough to have Scott Bessent on, and he worked with Soros, and he said in his mind unequivocally the single best investor he'd ever come across was Stan Druckenmiller, who of course would have taken outsized bets by traditional standards, but, you know, highly concentrated in the story of the shorting of the pound is one of the great stories. And I was sent a speech that Druckenmiller actually gave sometime after that, and it makes fantastic reading. We won't go into it here. Completely different question, because you are from Liverpool. The two great recent managers, Klopp and Slot, what do each of them have?
I think just they've got the ability to engage with people. And, you know, management is about engagement for me, and that they've got it. They engage with the fans. They obviously engage with the players. And ultimately if the fans love the manager, also probably the players do. So for me, that's the magic sauce.
Of course, you might be an Everton supporter.
Well, yeah, I could be, but yeah. But luckily, I'm not.
As my co-founder Will Campion is, which is why he doesn't talk about football. My final question is, lots of young people listening to these podcasts that we produce, and a lot of them interested in finance. You've got children. How do you advise, or how do you, what do you say to young people thinking about going into finance, given that what you've just said is it's become a much more institutionalized and risk-averse business?
I don't know about finance is a tricky one now, I would say, because it is so siloed. You know, I'm just sort of a great believer of, you know, you go to so many, say, dinner parties, or you sit next to people now, and so few people ask you questions. And, you know, for me, I just think all young people should be engaging. You know, if you've sat next to somebody, you should have asked them at least 20 questions. And for me, you know, young people just need to ask more questions and be interested in what other people do. and that was going to give them a steer on actually what they want to do. Yeah.
Well, look, Stephen, I think we've covered your mission, why you think that the opportunity set is so rich. I think your book, by the way, which we will, you know, talk about when we have the email release as well, is a great way for young people to, you know, sense that investing need not be as complicated as some would have it. And I'm going to give a copy of your book to my son, Henry. I know you have a son called Henry as well.
That's right.
I think that there is absolutely space on the investment pitch for people who are unequivocally pursuing higher risk, possibly concentrated, sometimes with leverage, you know, ideas, which, as you rightly say, doesn't mean that it is for everybody, but it does mean that for some, it can make a part of the overall portfolio allocation. And I think we've got sort of shades of grey going on in the investing world right now, and a little more sharp resolution might be
absolutely
welcome. So yeah. It's been great meeting you today, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is true and accurate as of the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the content. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed.